from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, it seems as if the entire nation was holding its breath for the Supreme Court ruling on health care, which came down earlier this morning. And we'll talk about it with legal scholars. It has implications for doctors, patients, politicians, and legal scholars, as well as states, including California. After many months, we'll dig into the court's ruling after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In a 5-4 landmark and historic decision, the United States Supreme Court released a ruling earlier this morning upholding the Obama health care law, the Affordable Care Act, including the individual mandate. The court ruled that the controversial mandate requiring Americans to buy health insurance is a tax rather than the government having the right to regulate interstate commerce. And in this morning's opening Forum hour, we get analysis and reaction to the decision. Joining us is Victor Amar, who is professor of law and associate dean for academic affairs at UC Davis School of Law. Vic Amar, good morning. Do we have Vic Amar?
I'm here.
Okay, got you there. Good morning, Vic.
Good morning, Michael.
I also want to say good morning to John Eastman, who is law professor and former dean of the Chapman University School of Law. And we should mention that Professor Eastman filed 3 briefs in the Supreme Court addressing the mandate and spending Medicaid issues. He's founding director for the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. Welcome, John Eastman.
Thanks, Michael, for having me back on your program.
Glad to have you back and glad to have you both here to do analysis with us in this and get your reactions to this historic event. Let me begin first with Professor Vikram Amar. Vikram Amar, in many ways a big surprise, especially since it was prognosticated that if anybody was going to be the swing vote, it would be Justice Kennedy, not Chief Justice Roberts.
I think that was conventional wisdom, but there were a lot of people who speculated that Chief Justice Roberts, especially because of his time in the federal government and his familiarity and sophistication with tax matters, might be interested in this taxation argument that he ultimately wrote about and provided the margin of victory. So I think, you know, in most cases that break down 5-4, Justice Kennedy is the swing vote. But when it comes to federal powers, Chief Justice Roberts now has a few cases under his belt where he has indicated a pretty generous view towards the federal government.
And perhaps some views which may not make him as popular as he might have been among his at least thought to be fellow conservatives. Wondering, there were several opinions divided. Maybe you could sketch this for us and give us a better understanding, because even on the question of whether this is a tax, which Justice Roberts wrote, as opposed to interstate commerce, there were divided opinions.
Sure. So you had basically 4 justices, led by Justice Scalia, who said this is neither a valid regulation of interstate commerce nor a valid tax, and so the mandate should be struck down. You had 4 justices, led by Justice Ginsburg, who said it is both a valid regulation of interstate commerce and a valid tax. And then you had Chief Justice Roberts, who kind of had one foot in both camps, and he says, I don't think it's a valid regulation of interstate commerce, and I'm not sure I agree with Chief Justice Roberts' reasoning there, by the way, but I do find it to be a valid tax. So when you count noses, there were 5 justices who said it was a valid tax, and it doesn't really matter how many different powers Congress has to justify its law. It needs only one.
And Professor Eastman, there was also a ruling, and a divided ruling, of course, on expanding Medicaid. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. I'm less confident of the breakdown on that one. I will tell you the outcome, and that is Congress decided to pretty broadly expand the Medicaid programs. In the initial years, they're going to be funding 100% of that expansion, but a few years down the road, that starts whittling down so that the states pick up an increasingly large share of that expansion. For a state concerned about the cost to its budget of that expansion, they were given the option of opting out, as they are on all spending programs. But the cost to them would not be taking advantage of the new funding, but they would lose all of their existing Medicaid funding for the existing programs that have been in place since 1965. The court said that that penalty of the existing funding was unconstitutional, but instead of striking down the expansion of Medicaid itself, it just basically severed out the penalty and said, if you want to threaten the states with not giving them the additional new funding, you can do that, but you can't reach to existing funding.
So what's your reaction, John Eastman, to the divide here in terms of congressional power and the definition of what a tax is?
Well, I think one of the things that is probably a surprise to many in the legal academy, although not the few on my side of the political aisle on this thing, is the strength of the challenge under the Commerce Clause. And the fact that that got 5 votes on the Supreme Court of the United States is hugely significant, it seems to me. But Chief Justice Roberts finding a way around that constitutional impediment through the taxing power, I think is just vindication for those of us who have been saying a long time that the revival of the notion that there are limits on the commerce power will ultimately mean little if we don't have a similar body of jurisprudence recognizing limits on the spending power. And I think Chief Justice Roberts' opinion demonstrates the correctness of that assessment.
Well, we're talking about the Health Care Act, which has been upheld, and there was a recent reaction from the presumptive Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, who some would say was responsible for this Health Care Act. But let's hear what former Governor Romney had to say.
What the court did not do on its last day in session, I will do on my first day if elected president of the United States. And that is, I will act to repeal Obamacare.
Now, this is shifting to a political arena, Vic Amar, it would seem. I mean, obviously. It's being heralded as a victory by the Obama administration, but you still have upwards of 68% or so of Americans being polled saying that they are not in favor of Obamacare. How do you just, assess this politically? The Republicans can maybe get a majority in the Senate and overturn Obamacare, or Mitt Romney's going to be elected and overturn it right away? Does it benefit the Romney and Republican?
Well, I don't know how it plays out in the election. I do know that presidents can't unilaterally repeal laws on their own. I mean, there's some things that the president could do if Romney is elected to kind of make Obamacare less ambitious. But it seems to me unlikely that Republicans are going to get a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate so that they could actually repeal the whole thing.
It almost sounded as if he was saying, I'm going to have an executive order when I become president. That's not even reasonable, is it?
I mean, candidates say all kinds of things. Now, Obamacare is such a hugely complicated piece of legislation that there are some things the president might be able to do to blunt some enforcement. But I think it is too quick to say he can just waltz in there and erase the whole thing. Let me just make 2 other points. One, I think the vote actually was 7-2 to strike down the conditions that Congress imposed on all states when it expanded the Medicaid coverage. So that was actually one where Justices Breyer and Kagan joined with the conservative 5 to say the federal government was bullying states a little bit too much here. And I think that will be an interesting and important body of law going forward. I'm not sure I fully agree with John, though, on the Commerce Clause grounds. I do think that a lot of people didn't expect there to be 5 votes to say Congress could not pass Obamacare under the Commerce Clause. But because the reasoning was so narrowly focused on this activity versus inactivity line, I think all it really does is it requires Congress to be more careful in the future when it does regulate commerce to make sure that it ties its regulation to some formal activity. But I think Congress can do that. And so this is a bit of a drafting exercise or a requirement on Congress to go forward.
Well, how do you read that, John Eastman? And how do you also read the response of Governor Romney? I'll get in and I'll repeal it.
He said he will launch the effort to repeal it, I think, which, although if you look at what the president has been doing in the last couple of weeks in the immigration front, issuing wholesale orders to exempt people from provisions of the law, we may have some precedent that would give the next president more authority to just say we're going to suspend enforcement of this. I tend to disagree with what the president has been doing there, but there are some important precedents being established. I think what he is more likely to do is work with Congress first to repeal, and I'm not convinced that this won't have a filibuster proof majority in the Senate by the time we're done with the election in November. There are a lot of there are a handful of Democrats who are in contested elections where this will now become the centerpiece of the election. And if those elections require those Democrats to make a pretty strong pledge that they will not filibuster an attempt to repeal, you may have a different dynamic going in than the normal partisan lineup that would suggest we'd need 60 votes. And there are also lots of things that the Congress can do through the budget process on appropriations that would curtail or deauthorize implementation efforts through the agencies in town. So I think this will become front and center for the election going into November, and we'll see what happens.
Well, we're going to be possibly in a moment or so moving to the White House where President Obama is about to speak. In fact, here he is.
That here in America, in the wealthiest nation on earth, no illness or accident should lead to any family's financial ruin. I know there will be a lot of discussion today about the politics of all this, about who won and who lost. That's how these things tend to be viewed here in Washington. But that discussion completely misses the point. Whatever the politics, today's decision was a victory for people all over this country whose lives will be more secure because of this law and the Supreme Court's decision to uphold it. And because this law has a direct impact on so many Americans, I want to take this opportunity to talk about exactly what it means for you. First, if you're one of the more than 250 million Americans who already have health insurance, you will keep your health insurance. This law will only make it more secure and more affordable. Insurance companies can no longer impose lifetime limits on the amount of care you receive. They can no longer discriminate against children with pre-existing conditions. They can no longer drop your coverage if you get sick. They can no longer jack up your premiums without reason. They are required to provide free preventive care like checkups and mammograms, a provision that's already helped 54 million Americans with private insurance. And by this August, nearly 13 million of you will receive a rebate from your insurance company because it spent too much on things like administrative costs and CEO bonuses and not enough on your health care. There's more. Because of the Affordable Care Act, young adults under the age of 26 are able to stay on their parents' health care plans, a provision that's already helped 6 million young Americans. And because of the Affordable Care Act, seniors receive a discount on their prescription drugs, a discount that's already saved more than 5 million seniors on Medicare about $600 each. All of this is happening because of the Affordable Care Act. These provisions provide common sense protections for middle-class families, and they enjoy broad popular support. And thanks to today's decision, all of these benefits and protections will continue for Americans who already have health insurance. Now, if you're one of the 30 million Americans who don't yet have health insurance, starting in 2014, this law will offer you an array of quality, affordable private health insurance plans to choose from. Each state will take the lead in designing their own menu of options. And if states can come up with even better ways of covering more people at the same quality and cost, this law allows them to do that too. And I've asked Congress to help speed up that process and give states this flexibility in year one. Once states set up these health insurance marketplaces, known as exchanges, insurance companies will no longer be able to discriminate against any American with a pre-existing health condition. They won't be able to charge you more just because you're a woman. They won't be able to bill you into bankruptcy. If you're sick, you'll finally have the same chance to get quality, affordable health care as everyone else. And if you can't afford the premiums, you'll receive a credit that helps pay for it. Today, the Supreme Court also upheld the principle that people who can afford health insurance should take the responsibility to buy health insurance. This is important for two reasons. First, when uninsured people who can afford coverage get sick and show up at the emergency room for care, the rest of us end up paying for their care in the form of higher premiums. And second, if you ask insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions but don't require people who can afford it to buy their own insurance, some folks might wait until they're sick to buy the care they need, which would also drive up everybody else's premiums. That's why, even though I knew it wouldn't be politically popular and resisted the idea when I ran for this office, we ultimately included a provision in the Affordable Care Act that people who can afford to buy health insurance should take the responsibility to do so. In fact, this idea has enjoyed support from members of both parties, including the current Republican nominee for president. Still, I know the debate over this law has been divisive. I respect the very real concerns that millions of Americans have shared. And I know a lot of coverage through this health care debate has focused on what it means politically. Well, it should be pretty clear by now that I didn't do this because it was good politics. I did it because I believed it was good for the country. I did it because I believed it was good for the American people. You know, there's a framed letter that hangs in my office right now. It was sent to me during the health care debate by a woman named Natoma Canfield. For years and years, Natoma did everything right. She bought health insurance, she paid her premiums on time. But 18 years ago, Natoma was diagnosed with cancer. And even though she'd been cancer-free for more than a decade, her insurance company kept jacking up her rates year after year. And despite her desire to keep her coverage, despite her fears that she would get sick again, she had to surrender her health insurance and was forced to hang her fortunes on chance. I carried Natoma's story with me every day of the fight to pass this law. It reminded me of all the Americans all across the country who have had to worry not only about getting sick, but about the cost of getting well. Natoma is well today, and because of this law, there are other Americans, other sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers, who will not have to hang their fortunes on chance. These are the Americans for whom we passed this law. The highest court in the land has now spoken. We will continue to implement this law, and we'll work together to improve on it where we can. But what we won't do, what the country can't afford to do, is refight the political battles of 2 years ago or go back to the way things were. With today's announcement, it's time for us to move forward, to implement and, where necessary, improve on this law. And now's the time to keep our focus on the most urgent challenge of our time, putting people back to work, paying down our debt, and building an economy where people can have confidence that if they work hard, they can get ahead. But today, I'm as confident as ever that when we look back 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, we'll be better off because we had the courage to pass this law and keep moving forward. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless America.
That was President Barack Obama live from the White House. And what you heard, of course, was the president talking about the centerpiece of his presidency, which is the Affordable Health Care Act, which has been upheld by the Supreme Court. It was upheld earlier this morning, and highlighting what the administration intends to do in the way of implementation and improving the law, and also talking about the advantages of the Affordable Health Care law and what it will bring to Americans. We have both John Eastman and Vikram Amar with us doing analysis of this law. And I'm struck, Vic Amar, by the fact that the constitutional lawyers really that are working for President Obama didn't foresee the interstate commerce constitutional question being as strong as it was. And to a great degree, they probably didn't foresee what Judge Roberts would lay down as this being a tax.
Well, that's not quite true in the sense that the tax argument was always included in the lower courts and in the briefing in the Supreme Court.
Let me rephrase that. I think they were more concerned about the interstate commerce than they were about the tax, right?
Well, I think they thought that the Commerce Clause argument was a strong one. I actually do still think it's a strong one, even though it only got four votes. But I think they knew from the outset that they might have to appeal to different justices on different bases, which is why, although politically they did not highlight the tax argument because tax is such a dirty word, it was always part of the legal briefing. Now, by not highlighting it more, they ran a risk that the court would take that signal and diminish it, as many of the justices did. But Chief Justice Roberts, I think because he thought it was important to give the federal government every benefit of the doubt, and because at the end of the day he thought this is the kind of thing that Congress should be recognized to have the power to do, rested his decision on the tax clause.
Well, let me go back to John Eastman. What's your response, John Eastman, to Justice Roberts' reasoning on that tax issue?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on the one of the key assumptions on that reasoning, and that is that this is not a direct tax. The reason this is critical is the Constitution imposes allows Congress to impose certain kinds of taxes, impose an excise taxes, for example, and direct taxes. And then by amendment, the Constitution now allows us to impose an income tax. The condition on imposing a direct tax is that it has to be apportioned according to population. Now, this one is neither an excise tax nor an income tax, and by all appearances, it is therefore a direct tax. And the constitutional challenge at the heart of Roberts' opinion here is if it's a direct tax, it's not apportioned according to population, it's therefore unconstitutional. And he just, with ipsa dixit, conclusory, says it's not a direct tax. He doesn't offer any explanation of what he thinks it is. He just says it's not a direct tax, so I don't have to confront that constitutional problem. I think as we parse this opinion and kind of look at the logic and the reasoning of it, I think that short-circuiting of that critical issue is going to be an intensely important part of the focus.
And what do you think about Professor Marr's statement that the court was wrong on the interstate commerce regulation?
Well, I disagree. I'm part of the effort in the country to restore the limits on the commerce power. I think the court got it exactly right there. It's what we have been pushing for since the 1970s, to restore the notion that all of the powers of Congress are limited. And the nuances of that Commerce Clause reasoning, that you can't create an impact on commerce in order to regulate it. The necessary and proper clause is a means to support a regulation of commerce, and that means there has to be commerce that you're regulating before you can impose a restriction on it. I think all of that nuance is a proper understanding of the Commerce Clause that bodes well for getting that part of the enumerated powers doctrine correct. But as the Chief Justice's opinion makes clear, that fight is irrelevant if I can do exactly the same thing by manipulating how I use the tax power. And I think that's a fair description of what's going on here. We're manipulating the tax power to impose commerce regulations when I've just said we don't have the commerce power authority to do so.
And you say what, Vic Amar?
A few things. I do agree with John that the Chief Justice's opinion was not really detailed in its explanation, either in upholding the tax power and characterizing this as not a direct tax, although I think he does say more than John suggested. He says it's not a direct tax because there are exemptions. You can avoid it by procuring the insurance, so you're not subject to it just as a matter of being the way a direct tax you can't avoid altogether. So I think there's some there, but he could have said more. But by the same token, I think the, quote, nuance that John refers to, that he, in rejecting the Commerce Clause argument, is not there. He says the Constitution says you can regulate commerce, but regulate doesn't mean create. But there's lots of provisions in the Constitution where the word regulate kind of is used to create something on which to base a regulation. So I think this opinion by Chief Justice Roberts was not supposed to be one that kind of is long and ponderous, and that law professors and law students kind of use in kind of complicated ways in the future. I think it was more to get a job done. And when you take a step back, this was a brilliant move by Chief Justice Roberts. Remember, he came onto the court with the umpire analogy that a lot of people thought was facile, and people have kind of accused him of being more partisan than he pretended to be in the hearing, or at least that people thought he was going to be. For the rest of his career, he's insulated now from the charge that he's a political hack, because in the biggest case in the court's docket in decades, he ruled for the government.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion with Professors Vic Amar and John Eastman, and you're invited to join us. What's your reaction to the Affordable Health Care ruling? 866-733-6786. Join us or email forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The nation, from all political perspectives, was eagerly awaiting this ruling that came down earlier this morning from the U.S. Supreme Court on health care. The Affordable Health Care Act has been upheld, the so-called Obamacare, or President Obama's administration's health care bill. And it is sort of our task here to parse this and figure out as much as we can with two leading legal scholars what it means, and particularly about the individual mandate, which, of course, was the centerpiece and the linchpin of and the most hotly argued part of this Affordable Health Care Act. We heard earlier from President Obama from the White House, but we're speaking with John Eastman, who's law professor and former dean of the Chapman University School of Law and also founding director for the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, and Vikram Amar, who is professor of law and associate dean for academic affairs at UC Davis School of Law. If you have a reaction to the ruling, or if you have some thoughts that you'd like to share with us and bring into this conversation, or if you have questions, we certainly welcome your participation, and you can join us now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We do welcome your phone calls, and it's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. Number of other ways to respond and let us know what you're thinking. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment and register your comment or your question there, or go to our Facebook page. But we certainly would like to bring you into the conversation, and we'll do that. First, before we begin hearing from listeners, I wanted to get Professor Eastman's response to what we just heard from Vic Amar, and then also get a bit of perspective on how this is going to affect California from Anthony Wright. John Eastman, I know you have a reaction and perhaps even some arguments with what we just heard before we went to the break from Vikram Amar.
I was following your subsequent conversation. If I may, let me go back to, I think, a couple of things the president said, because we haven't gotten to that yet. The president obviously is focusing on the parts of this that have greater support. But what I found most interesting about those comments is that he did this despite the politics, which means I did this despite the overwhelming majority of American citizens not wanting to have a mandate imposed on them, because I think it's good for you, and I know better than you what's good for you.
Or because it was, to use his words on Arizona, the right thing to do.
Well, that's right. But, we tend not to have a kingship here where the king decides what's the right thing to do against the will and of the overwhelming majority of the citizenry. This is a rather dramatic claim at issue here. And the other thing we should focus on, everybody talks about, your ability to show up to emergency room and get coverage, whether you have health insurance or not. Of course, that's a mandate imposed by the federal government that has created this problem. But if that was the issue, and if that's what we were trying to solve, we could have done it with a much narrower statute. We could have required you to have a catastrophic care policy instead of this kind of comprehensive insurance policy that now everybody will be forced to buy. And what that results in is two things. Businesses that currently offer health care plans will increasingly choose not to do so because the costs will not pencil out for them. And we will move rather quickly to a government-run health care system. And the second thing that means is that young, healthy people will now be heavily subsidizing wealthier, middle-aged and older people with the health insurance, because it is in their interest not to have these comprehensive health insurance policies when they're very unlikely to need them, and instead to only have a catastrophic care policy. So this is a massive transfer of wealth from the young and healthy to the wealthier, middle-aged folks who are going to be on the beneficiary side of this. And when that becomes clear, I think you're going to have some very interesting dynamics demographically in our politics that start playing out.
Well, there was, and I'm just curious to get your responses also, John Eastman, a lot of rhetoric around Americans being forced to buy broccoli. I mean, I never quite understood the analogy there. It seemed to me palpably absurd, frankly. But the sense that you are kind of putting forward here is that there's going to be a lot more regulation as a result of this. I'm talking about the decision with vis-a-vis tax now as opposed to interstate commerce.
Well, I think that's right. And had it been upheld under either ground, I think we would see a lot more regulation. Let me explain the broccoli analogy, and it's only an analogy, but it's this. If the government makes a determination that a certain conduct by you is beneficial to your health, and if you act in ways that are not beneficial to your health, the taxpayers are likely to have to pick up some of those costs. whether obesity or what have you, then we can start regulating more pervasively the things that you do to yourself to avoid those health care costs. And eating broccoli means that you're eating more healthy, and therefore your health care costs are going to be lower. If you eat, you know, 12 cheeseburgers a day and what have you, you're going to increase the cost, and we can regulate that as well. And so because it's all tied to your ability to transfer costs to a health care system rather than bear those costs yourself, we're going to be able to regulate all sorts of things. And that's the nature of the analogy. And I think, quite frankly, it's an apt one. It was one that the courts on the Commerce Clause analysis accepted in the trial court down in Florida and what have you, because what you're trying to tease out is the implications of the rationale that the government is offering. What could we do, and whether politically they would do that or not? The rationale, had this been upheld on Commerce Clause grounds, would have been there to do those kind of things if Congress deemed them necessary. And you really destroy any notion that there's a limited government and enumerated powers that way.
I don't know about actuarial modeling on broccoli mandates, but I know, Vic Amar, that we finance retirement insurance through Social Security and hospital insurance through Medicare.
Yeah, I mean, and those are kind of more straightforward taxes, I think John would say, because they're taxes on employment activity. But let's stick with this broccoli analogy, because I think it's important. You know, one thing that John and I agree on is that there are limits to what the federal government should be able to do, and courts are there to help police those limits. But the line that Chief Justice Roberts and the other four justices who joined him on the Commerce Clause drew doesn't really do that. They said you can't regulate inactivity. You cannot require activity, because that opens up huge new domains of federal power. Let's stick with the broccoli analogy. Let's assume that that John is right, that you can't force someone to purchase or to eat broccoli. But what if Congress passed a law instead that said no one shall purchase any vegetable or other food besides broccoli? Now, that's a regulation of direct activity, the foods that you purchase. It's banning purchase of things that are not broccoli. The majority opinion today does not call into question Congress's power to do that. If Congress lacks the power to do that, then it's because we already have other tools in our kind of toolkit besides this activity-inactivity line to keep Congress from doing ridiculous things. But if Congress could prohibit the purchase of all foods other than broccoli, then what's the difference between that and requiring the purchase of broccoli? So I don't disagree that we need tools and lines, but I'm just saying this activity-inactivity line that the court kind of tried to create today is just, as Justice Ginsburg pointed out in her opinion, it's rather specious.
All right. I want to actually bring Anthony Wright into this. I know, John Eastman, you might have a response to what you just heard, but Anthony Wright's executive director of the Health Access California. They're a nonprofit dedicated to achieving quality and affordable health care for all Californians. Anthony Wright, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nearly a half million Californians, we should bring into the picture here, would have lost their health insurance if the law had been overturned. So I suppose from your perspective, obviously this is good news.
It's a great relief to nearly half a million Californians who would have lost coverage, millions of Californians who would have lost key consumer protections, whether it's the no limits on no caps on coverage or no cost sharing for preventative care, or whether it's the 11,000 folks who are in a pre-existing condition insurance program, people who have been denied by insurers because of pre-existing conditions, now getting coverage through a federally funded program as a bridge to 2014, those folks would have been left out in the cold, uninsured and uninsurable if they had struck down the entire law. We here in California are aggressively taking advantage of some of the new benefits of the law, and this allows us to move forward full speed ahead because, frankly, California has a very severe crisis in health care, and the ACA gives us the framework and the funding to help address those issues.
Yeah, there are 46 million without health insurance, and yet if the ruling had gone the other way, you were perfectly prepared to move full steam ahead, as I understand it.
Well, that's right, but it would have been incredibly difficult to do so if we didn't have that federal framework and funding, to do the expansion of Medicaid to 2 million Californians, to provide subsidies for people to be able to better afford coverage. I mean, it's a profound change. In 2014, we're going to go from a world where people pay insurance based on how sick they are to how much they can afford based on a percentage of their income. Just to counter one of the things I heard earlier about the issue of young and old, young people are going to get a big benefit from this, not just because they're staying on their parents' coverage up to age 26, which 350,000 Californians do already, but because young people tend to be lower income, and they're going to get subsidies to be able to afford coverage. So it's a boon to them as well as to older folks who are the most likely to be denied for pre-existing conditions.
Anthony Wright, again, is Executive Director of Healthcare Access California. Anthony, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And we're going to bring Professor Eastman back, but first let me go to a call here, and that's John in Half Moon Bay. John, join us.
Yes. My question is, when I've in the discussions leading up to this, I've heard something called the tax injunction principle, which says that you can't really challenge a tax until it's been levied. And so I'm wondering if anyone thinks there's an element of Justice Roberts' reasoning that would lead you to believe he's just playing possum and waiting for this to kick in and then say, well, no, it's not a legal tax.
Yeah, I thought it was an appropriate question for you, John Eastman, and you may want to also give some response to what you heard from Professor Amar.
Yeah, so I do think there's a bit of a clever nuance here, Chief Justice Roberts. The issue is if it's a tax, you have to pay the tax first and then seek a refund, and when the refund is denied, only then can you challenge the constitutionality of the tax. We have that statute in place, so we wouldn't have millions of challenges to taxes that show up every April 14th so that people could delay paying their taxes. But he says it's not a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act because Congress didn't call it a tax. But whether they called it a tax or not, it certainly does act like a tax, and therefore for purposes of the Constitution's taxing power, it's a legitimate exercise of that taxing power. That's a very nuanced duck of what when that question was asked at oral argument, almost everybody in the room laughed at it. Justice Breyer said, I think what the government meant to argue is that it's not a tax for purpose of the Injunction Act, but it's an exercise of the taxing power. And it was a nuance that seemed laughable at the time, and yet it's critical to John Roberts' opinion here.
Let me thank the caller for the question. Actually, on point here is Pam, who writes, what I find fascinating is how pundits were completely taken by surprise by the court upholding the Affordable Care Act as a legitimately enacted tax. It underscores just how successful Grover Norquist has been in banishing all talks of taxation from the political landscape. Congress couldn't begin to pass this act if the word tax was used, so they twisted their language, fooling themselves and their constituents that the mandate was different from a tax. The no-tax dogma is so powerful that no pundits even use this frame to predict the outcome. It amazes me that the political dialogue, not just among politicians, but by the media too, has been so twisted by the no-taxes mantra. Let me get some more of your responses, and we'll go to Dave next in Oakland. Dave, join us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment a little bit about that conversation that's going on in the media, because earlier in the week we had Scalia making political statements from the bench, and here we have Roberts kind of doing something that's very anti-political in that sense, and instead of doing the kind of the broccoli arguments that Scalia was kind of using. I really just wanted to kind of point out that it looks like Roberts is kind of doing more of a lawyerly opinion and less of a rhetorical political volley from the judicial branch of government.
Well, there's another spin on that, and I thank you for the call. There was, in fact, more from the conservative side, John Eastman, some suspicions that had been aroused about Justice Roberts before this, and I think those will be probably heightened by this. I'm talking about where he falls politically and
right.
What can be expected of him.
There's a third spin, in fact, that this was the most political decision. Look, the 70-some percent of the people don't like the mandate. It's a huge albatross around the president's neck going into the election in November. And by keeping that albatross around the neck, Chief Justice Roberts, who acted contrary to what everybody assumed he would do in enforcing the limits on the Constitution, may have exercised the most political judgment ever. I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened, but that's a third spin.
It is a third spin. Okay, and we'll go to another caller. Don, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, I got a question here. Take, for example, a person who does not own an automobile. Could they be required to carry automobile insurance under the assumption that sometime in an emergency they might be required to drive an automobile?
Want to give an answer to that, Vikram Amar?
Well, Congress could certainly require people to pay a tax if they used the roadways. So again, it's easy to posit hypotheticals that push the boundaries, and I think when those laws are passed, you have to analyze what the state of the world is at that time that explains whether the law passed really bears any relationship to the way markets happen to be working. Same is true, at oral argument they asked, well, could you require people to purchase funeral insurance if you can require them to purchase health insurance since everyone's going to die? Well, the answer to that is people aren't crossing state lines to die and to go to impose costs on other states. You know, Massachusetts is not becoming a magnet for people to come die, but there is a concern that they're a magnet for people to come get health care. People aren't failing to move to another state because they're fearful of giving up their health insurance. They're not fearful of moving to another state because they're worried about giving up their funeral insurance. So laws have to be examined in the context of the reality in which they are adopted.
I wanted our listeners to hear, and both you, Vikram Amar, and John Eastman, to hear another cut from Governor Romney, and this is having to do with Americans needing choice.
He wasn't ready. All right,
we're trying to get that cut ready. I wanted to bring it up on the one hand because I keep thinking about the backlash in this. The figure we heard from John Eastman, about 70% opposed to the mandate and high 60% opposed to health care, may indeed wind up helping Romney. On the other hand, it's certainly a victory for the Obama administration by any lights because it's at the center. I don't want to get into politics too much. We're really trying to parse the legal side of this here. But there's been a strong backlash, particularly that we ought to take note of, from the Catholics in the United States, who are arguing that this mandate would require religious institutions to offer health insurance that covers birth control and abortion. Vikram Amar, how do you read that?
Well, that's a whole separate kind of basis for objection, the specifics that fall into a health care plan that someone has to provide. And the administration has tried to, I think, craft a compromise with religious objections, and that's happening both at the federal level and it's happening in states that have similar requirements. But let's go back.
Excuse me, that's what President Obama meant then by trying to improve the law, you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think what this decision does is it pushes the debate back to where it belongs in the political chambers. And then, no one is saying that this is a perfect law. I'm not even saying it's a great law in the healthcare industry. I don't know enough about healthcare policy to say it's a good law. The question, though, for the court was whether Congress had the power to go down this road. And just because they took a step down this road doesn't mean they're not going to tweak it going forward. But I agree with you that we want to stick with the law and not the politics. But we have to make one point, and that is these polls that say people object to the law and people object to the mandate also suggest that people don't know what's in the law. And they don't know that the mandate is centrally tied to the ban on pre-existing condition discrimination. So like all polls, these polls really turn on how much knowledge the person being polled has and how you ask the question. And we should make that clear, because it's not at all clear that having Obamacare remain in force is going to hurt the president in this election. It might, but that's not entirely clear.
Well, actually, this brings up another question from a listener named Jim, who, and be interested in your response to this, John Eastman. Jim says, I don't understand why the Republicans hate this health care law so much. Could one of the guests helped me out with a summary of their gripes and how they think railing against it helps them?
Yeah, I mean, the basic essence of it is Congress is doing something that's not a regulation of commerce. It's not a tax. They claim that from the beginning, that the chief has manipulated the taxing power to authorize this means that Congress can do whatever it wants, and the very notion of limited government is no longer in place. We have notions of limited government for a very reason. We have to have government to facilitate trade, to protect us in our individual rights and liberties, but the founders also recognize that government that became too powerful could itself become tyrannical, and that's why we have limits on the powers given to the federal government. We have checks and balances between the branches. We have systems of federalism where most of the day-to-day governing decisions that affect our lives are supposed to be handled at the state or local level, which is where health care has traditionally been dealt with, so that you can have different states trying different things, and if it becomes too cumbersome in one place, you still have the exit option to move to another. When you nationalize the health care system, those exit options and that, therefore those competitive pressures to get it right no longer exist, and government becomes increasingly expansive, and then you can end up with regulations like we've seen coming out of HHS that compels people to comply with regulations that violate their conscience. And those are the stakes when you have a government that's so powerful it can basically do anything it wants.
All right, I said earlier I wanted to hear this cut from former Governor Romney. Let's hear it.
You can choose whether you want to have a larger and larger government, more and more intrusive in your life, separating you and your doctor, whether you're comfortable with more deficits, higher debt that we pass on to the coming generations, whether you're willing to have the government put in place a plan that potentially causes you to lose the insurance that you like, or whether instead you want to return to a time when the American people will have their own choice in health care, where consumers will be able to make their choices as to what kind of health insurance they want. This is a time of choice for the American people.
Well, that, again, answers Jim's question. I mean, that's the presumptive Republican nominee stating, again, the opposition to the health care law. Let me get some more of your calls on here. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, obviously I haven't had time to read the opinion, and I'm a single-payer advocate anyway. But how can one-seventh of the economy not be part of commerce? I had a stroke. I take 9 pills a day. Half of them are generic, so they come from India. One of them is very profitable and taken by a lot of people. You see advertisements for it on national television every night. How can you seriously argue that that's not commerce?
And you say what, Professor Eastman?
So you already make an assumption that commerce is economic, which is itself an expansion of our understanding of the Commerce Clause that occurred in the 1930s, not consistent with the original understanding of the Constitution. Commerce was the trade, and so I could regulate the pills coming across state lines or, as you mentioned, international lines, but I can't force people how they go about going to visit their doctor down the street, because that's not interstate commerce. It certainly is part of the economy, but it's not commerce. It's not trade, and so we already have one pretty dramatic expansion of the powers of Congress there. And I think what the court is doing here and has been doing since 1995 is restoring some notion that commerce is not regulating everything in the economy. Commerce is regulating the trade, the intercourse between the states, not the relationship that individuals have with their local doctor.
And let me go back, if I may, Vic Amar, with you to that comment that we heard from Republican presidential nominee, presumptive nominee, Mitt Romney on choice. It would appear that the Supreme Court said that you have the choice to either get the care or pay the tax.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion said in explaining why this was not a direct tax is that you can escape the tax by simply procuring insurance, and that's not true of traditional direct taxes, which you pay just as a basis of being. So there is some choice. And again, you know, maybe some people will think, well, this is not a good federal law to have. We should leave it to the states. The question isn't what the best policy is. The question is, does Congress have the power? And, you know, I don't agree with John that commerce includes only the transaction itself. He talks about the founding era. Well, Chief Justice John Marshall in Gibbons versus Ogden in the 1800s made clear that commerce includes not just the transaction, but all the things that lead up to it and ensue from it. So I think John is at least honest that he wants to wash away a lot of developments in the past 150 years of Supreme Court history, and Justice Thomas is also very open about that. But if you want to kind of live with the system that we've had in the Supreme Court case law for a while, I agree with the caller. You know, it's hard to say that the health insurance and health coverage are not national concerns that Congress has a reason to be interested in.
Reading a couple of comments here from listeners, again, about the whole question of tax. Chris from San Jose writes, now, isn't this now a tax on the poor? If you couldn't pay for health care before, you probably can't now. So now you have a new tax. You have to pay for something you can't afford, forcing the problem even deeper. Where does this end? Can the government now say you have to buy a Ford to boost the American economy? If not, we can tax you? Another listener, Charles, writes, if the court found that the Affordable Health Care is a tax, why do they not find that the Tax Anti-Junction Act applies? That limits what cases federal courts are allowed to hear in tax cases. Comments from you, Vikamar?
Sure. The Tax Injunction Act is not a constitutional limit on the court. It's a statute that Congress passed that Congress could repeal tomorrow. So what Chief Justice Roberts said, and I found it totally plausible, is that Congress, even by styling it a penalty in the statute, means they indicated they did not want the Tax Injunction Act and other laws that Congress has passed that limit the court's abilities to hear tax challenges to apply. So Congress essentially took this ACA out of the Tax Injunction Act when it passed it, but that's a very different question than whether it falls within Congress's power to raise revenue. We talk about the tax power, but there are all kinds of other provisions in the Constitution that talk about Congress's power to raise revenue. So we shouldn't get hung up on the tax word. As a constitutional matter, we look to see what a law does, not what label Congress has given to it.
Well, that label is there, though, and I'm wondering, actually, John Eastman, we've got just about a minute left here, but a couple of emails along these lines. A listener writes, well, I'm a big supporter of universal health care, and I'm relieved that the court upheld this legislation. I'm a bit troubled by the tax reasoning. Is there precedent for government requiring all citizens to pay taxes to a third party, i.e. insurers in this case? And another listener says, does anybody realize that there's going to be a 3.8% tax on every home sold after 2012 to help fund this?
Yeah, no, this now may be one of the largest tax increases in American history, and the president's claims that this was not a tax and that he was not going to impose a tax on the middle class may become part of the election campaign as well. This may be a Pyrrhic victory for him, but the legal analysis, and I think the direct tax analysis we're going to focus on down the road, the notion that some people are exempt from it doesn't destroy the fact that it's a direct tax. It does make it not a tax apportioned according to population, which is a very constitutional question that Chief Justice Roberts seems conclusorily to reject.
Well, we've come to the end of this hour, and what a historic hour it's been. I mean, grappling with what the Supreme Court decision of the upholding of the Affordable Health Care Act means, I want to thank Vikram Amar, Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at UC Davis School of Law, and John Eastman, who's law professor and former dean of Chapman University School of Law and also founding director for the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. Also, my thanks to Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Healthcare Access California, and thanks, of course, to you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Amy Machado, and Amanda Stupai. And thanks again to all of you. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.